The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Dillis Powell, Frank Muir, Anne Scott James, and Dennis Norton. Here's round one to test their vocabularies. 2 marks if they get these words more or less right. Beginning with Dillis Powell. Dillis, what is a flageolet? F-L-A-G-E-O-L-E-T, flageolet.
Kind of bean.
That's one thing, and it's also something else.
It's the thing you play, it's kind of flute.
Yes, that'll do. You get your 2 marks. It's a small flute, which I think you blow from the end rather than the side, if I remember rightly, and also a kind of kidney bean. It can be a stop on an organ that you play in a church. Then it's not the meaning of the verb imbrue, I-M-B-R-U-E, imbrue.
Imbrue, yes, that, I think, was one of the loveliest rhapsodies that Gershwin ever wrote. Imbrue.
Is it to drench?
Yes.
Or yes. Drench?
That's part of it.
Yes.
But surely it means a shower, doesn't it? Imber means a shower. I thought just to drench would do.
Moisten is quite right. It means to stain, but usually to stain your hands or your sword with the blood of your enemies. And this is what makes it rather nasty.
Give them.
1.5 out of 2. Anne Scott James, the meaning of Pergamenius, P-E-R-G-A-M-E-N-E-O-U-S, Pergamenius. Adjective.
Oh, I think it's somebody who came from Pergamum, frankly.
Originally. Yes, that's getting you part of the distance. They made something particular in Pergamum.
Well, there's a Pergamon Press, which is a publishing company.
Did they make a die in Pergamum?
Yes, and Dennis is on the way, though.
It's something to do with publishing. With books.
Yes, something with books. But haven't quite
something to do
it.
With paper or
yes.
Ink. Parchment.
Yes.
Parchmenty.
Parchmenty it is. You've crept home. All more like parchment. The point is that the town of Pergamum in Asia Minor was the place where they first learnt the art of preparing sheepskins so that you could write on them as parchment.
It's after they take them off the sheep.
It started with that.
It's very difficult to find the page. You know.
And now, Frank Muir, what is a lunarian? L-U-N-A-R-I-A-N, lunarian.
Well, an alien is an inhabitant of, isn't he? Somebody who comes from.
Yes.
Lou, he's a sort of professional gentleman. A professional gentleman.
He might.
Is he not?
He might be. There isn't much evidence as to whether he's a gentleman or not.
Is it Luna?
Yes.
Lunarian?
Yes.
Somebody who, from the moon.
From the moon?
An inhabitant of the moon? Or
yes.
Somebody who's a student of, it could be, too.
That's right. You've got it absolutely dead right. Lunarian. An inhabitant of the moon, or an astronomer, or observer, or navigator who has rather special gen about the moon. 2 marks. Before we start round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and I want the 2 women members of the team to study those quotations, because at the end of the program, I shall ask them for the source of their quotation. Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, your quotation is, "So he passed over, and all the trumpets sounded for him on the other side." And Anne Scott James with Dennis, here's yours. "The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on." And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. So to round two, which is about legends and mythology. 2 marks for correct answers. Dennis Powell, who was Arachne? And I'm not going to spell it for you.
Arachne was a maiden.
With a spotty face.
She spun.
Yes?
She was very busy spinning.
Yes?
Oh, turning round. Dervish.
No, she was doing this sort of thing with a thread.
Oh.
Spinning with a thread. And somehow she got into difficulties with one of the guards. I should think she said she could spin better than somebody.
Yes, quite right.
They always did that.
Yeah, like disc jockeys.
And the god, it was the god, not a god, a goddess. The gods didn't spin, it was a goddess. And the goddess said, oh, nonsense, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
And turned her into a spider.
Yes, absolutely right. Well done. Dennis Norton, where did Pegasus come from?
Well, Pegasus was a horse.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble was with Greek legend that nothing had a proper mummy and daddy.
Yes.
In it. Either the mother was a swan or a tree or something. Or
came from Acro Corinth, didn't he? Didn't he come
landed
from a mountain
there.
Near...
Hmm? Landed on there, certainly.
Where did he start from?
Yes, this is the point.
London Airport, I think. Miss Fogbrown again.
Stick to the bit about Acro Corinth. What happened there? But this will give you part of it, anyway.
Well, there Bellerophon met him.
Yes.
And mounted him and rode him.
Yes, that's quite right.
That
one out of two.
Doesn't seem to be what you want.
No.
No, but he's happy.
Came from the sea,
yeah.
Possibly, did he?
He came from the sea.
Came from the sea.
One and a half.
He was a seahorse.
No, he's a winged horse, and as Anne Scott James quite rightly says, eventually tamed and ridden by the hero Bellerophon, but it was when Perseus was killing the Gorgon Medusa, cut off Medusa's head, and from the blood, the winged horse Pegasus sprang. One and a half. Anne Scott James, who was the Arcadian stag, or some people say the Arcadian hind?
Ah, oh, one of the labours of Hercules.
Yes?
It was to catch the Arcadian hind.
Yes? Do you remember what it looked like?
Well, Hercules is very good looking chap.
Let's stick to what he was catching.
What who looked like? The hind, I presume.
Yes.
I don't think I'm going to get much further.
Difficult. One out of two. It was a stag or a hind which had golden antlers and brazen feet, and it was, I think, Hercules' fourth job or labour to try and capture it, and he pursued it for a whole year. In fact, it turned up among the Hyperboreans, who were probably the Scots, so it may even have been the stag at bay, and then got it all the way back again, or it ran back, and he wounded it with an arrow and then managed to carry it away on his shoulders. Frank Muir, who was Andromeda's mother, and how did she finish up?
She's married to Andromeda's dad, and she finished up dead. Who's Andromeda?
Cassiopeia.
Yes. And what happened to her in the end? I think you both know this.
She was... she died. And she either was perpetual or she's a star. Always a star.
Absolutely right. You get your two marks. She was Cassiopeia. She became a star, or rather a constellation, and so did the daughter too, Andromeda. And that's the end of the story in that case. Two marks.
Mercifully brief.
Next round's about origins and derivations. Three marks if members of the team can first of all define the present meaning and then give me the origin and derivation of these words or expressions or phrases. Beginning with Dillis Powell, pieces of eight.
Pieces of eight?
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of coin.
Yes, what kind of coin?
Spanish, a doubloon.
Yes, that's it.
Mm. Of Treasure Island.
Ah.
Yes, it's mentioned in Treasure Island, quite right.
Pieces of eight. What have they had?
Have a shot at its value and what it was called.
Shot its value.
It's an eighth of something.
Yeah.
No,
eight times something.
Yes, that's
eight
right.
Eight times.
Well, it depends which way you look at it.
Eight.
Whatever it's an eighth of is a 64th of what I'm thinking about.
Eight doubloons.
Yes, not quite. Pieces of eight were the old Spanish silver peso, or dollar, worth eight reals, or royals. There's some confusion as to how much they were worth, but they're considering what the pound's been doing.
Why do you ask?
Not surprising. It's either worth about four and six, or it's worth about one and eight, and I'm not quite certain which is which. And they were marked by the figure eight, to show that they were like that, and they were in use in the 17th and 18th century, and as members of the team quite rightly said, they're mentioned in Stevenson's Treasure Island. Probably they were originally pesos of eight, you see. Dennis Norton, yours is quite different. The ashes.
Well, the ashes are the results of the test match rubbers between England and Australia.
And how come?
It was some dreadful joke in Punch, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Yes, it's either the ashes of the umpire who gave
they incinerated out. The first Batman.
Yeah. Punch made some pompous joke about the ashes of English cricket.
Yes, that's it. You've got there.
It's the ashes. Oh,
We've won.
Good, thank you.
Yes, I think you get your three. Now, Anne Scott James. Tawdry.
It means slightly sordid or dirtyish. Tawdry dress is a dress which isn't quite clean and fresh. And it comes from the Feast of St. Audrey, in my view.
Yes, it does. And what happened there?
Oh, tremendous fairgrounds and jollities. And it dates back to the finery which people used to wear at the Feast of St. Audrey.
She I think nice. That'll do. Isn't it?
3 marks. Something gaudy and over-ornamented, in bad taste and not worth much, and probably dirty as well as... Anne has suggested, and they had this fair of St. Audrey in the Isle of Ely, where they sold all sorts of cheap jewellery and a particular kind of rather showy lace, which was called St. Audrey's lace. Frank Muir, sink or swim?
Sink or swim means, you either survive or don't survive. You get through it or don't get through it.
Yes.
And derivation... Well, some things float and others don't.
Yes.
It's a test of flottance, of buoyancy, or usually of girlancy. Because it was... No, it was, I think, ordeal by water.
Yes, yes, you're getting that.
I think preceded ordeal by fire.
That's it.
And it was a long way before ordeal by jury. It was when that, if they found a heretic... Or somebody who dappled in the ogled.
Yes.
The test was to chuck them in the village pond.
Yes.
The theory being that if they sank, they were innocent and dead. And if they floated, they were guilty and were then put to death.
Yes.
So it was a fairly tidy way of clearing up suspects.
Absolutely right. Well done, Frank. 3 marks. Next round is initials and abbreviations. I want to know what these stand for. 2 marks, right answers. Phyllis Power, NSA.
NSA? All in capitals.
All in capitals.
National Surgical Association.
I don't think there is one.
Skating.
Skating.
Yes.
Skating.
Yes, Association. That's
right.
That'll do.
Oh.
Dennis Norton. FRS.
Oh, it's the Royal Society.
That's it.
Thing, isn't it? Mm. Yes. Father of the Royal...
Fellow
of the Royal Society.
Fellow of the Royal Society it is. The father of the Royal Society is Charles II, which is quite a long way back.
Good old Charles.
2 marks. Anne Scott James, FBI.
Oh, it used to be the Federation of British Industries, but that won't do anymore, will it?
No,
it's
won't
changed
do anymore.
Its name.
Yeah,
it must be the American one. Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Country?
America.
Thank you. 2 marks. Frank Muir. V.S. Capital.
V.S. The English equivalent of the Italian indication to musicians on music, which is P.P., which means very softly. It isn't often used, of course.
No.
V.S. Short for verb sap. Latin for nuff said.
Yes, it usually comes as verb sap. I've never seen V.S. as the used.
Well,
verb
you've heard
sap,
it.
Which is
it?
Yes, that's itself a contraction. I don't think you've got a double contraction.
I've seen it often.
Veterinary serves a circle.
No, not society. It's a chap.
What's a
veterinary
surgeon?
Surgical instrument operator.
Oh, they creep home. It's veterinary surgeon. That's the normal one. In the sport of mountaineering and rock climbing, it also stands for a very difficult climb, which is called very severe. And now we come to the last round and go back to those two quotations I gave the teams earlier in the program. 2 marks to Liz Powell. Can you give me the origin of your quotation? So he passed over, and all the trumpets sounded for him on the other side.
It's Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan.
John Bunyan. 2 marks it is. Now, Anne Scott James. The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on.
I think it's Omar Khayyam, the Rubaiyat of,
Persian.
Translated?
By Fitzgerald.
Yes, 2 marks it is. And I shall ask Frank and Dennis to tell me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever unlikely explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Frank Muir with his quotation. So he passed over, and all the trumpets sounded for him on the other side.
There's a publisher, Mark Bonham Carter, and a couple of weeks ago he was walking along by Hyde Park in Knightsbridge, and he heard somebody calling his name. They said, "Mark, Mark, Mark." He turned round, there's nobody there. Very strange experience, and he walked on a little further. This voice said, "Mark, Mark." And he looked down, and there at his ankles was a small dog with a hare lip. I mention this account because of this peculiar quality names have for being other things. I mean, did you know, for instance, that the Victoria and Albert Museum was named after 2 people? Victoria and Albert Museum was named after Frank Muir and Alastair Seam. And did you know that striptease was named after the man who brought it into this country in the closing years of the last century, Phineas Stripp? Is actually spelt differently, STRIPP. Phineas Stripp imported it from the gay shores of Gaul, from France, in Victorian times. And he used to open it up at the music hall he had there at tea time. And he used to hold little teas, and they were called strip teas, which is where it came from. And it really is a remarkable story of British pluck and guts and vim and grit. The story of how young Phineas Stripp got across to Paris in order to import these dancing girls who unclothed themselves. Now, the can-can was then going the rage in Paris, Moulin Rouge, and it was being painted by Toulouse-Lautrec. But they hadn't seen it in this country. And then he heard that at Dieppe and Calais and along the coast, they were doing the striptease. And apparently they got a whole batch of petite filles, a little pooler. They were little, actually. They were dreary girls who were sort of out of work clog chiselers. And they armed them each with a couple of enormous button hooks. And to the sound of Offenbach, they gradually unbuttoned themselves. They undid about 340 buttons. The whole thing took about 3/4 of an hour. And they took their outer clothes off and stripped down to a garment which reached from their knees to their ears of bulletproof invulnerability made of black bombazine. This doesn't sound very exciting now, but remember these were the days when an unclad piano leg was enough to mantle the cheek of the most worldly unmarried lady. And Phineas Stripp decided he must go over and see them work this undressing thing, this undoing all these buttons to the sound of the can-can music. So he got his own composer over here who wrote him some music. It was a fellow called Seldom Bite, Herbert Seldom Bite. His name isn't remembered much now, but in those days he was the English equivalent of Offenbach. And he wrote him the music. Young Phineas had the theatre, he had his theatre already, but how to get over to Paris, how to get across to France, he decided to swim. Immediately, he went round all the public houses and he collected all the champagne corks. And he threaded them on a long piece of string and wound them all round himself and flung himself into the mighty English Channel. He floated very well. He couldn't swim because his arms were all bound up. But he was rolled over by the tide, got as far as Dover, and the tide changed, and back he was on Folkestone Beach after a very comfortable 2 hours. He realized that now he had buoyancy, because now he wanted propulsion. So he remembered when he was young playing with a little piece of card and a little piece of camphor stuck in the back of the card. So he rushed to a ladies' outfitter's and he bought a pair of garments which an American lady, a Mrs. Amelia Bloomer, had just made popular for cycling. These were sort of long ladies' underwear with elastic just below the knee and at the waist. He bought himself a pair of these, double-strengthened the elastic, and he bought 14 gross packets of camphor balls. With those, he poured those into his bloomers at the back, wound all his corks round him, and plunged into the mighty English Channel. Well, the camphor worked. There was a sort of fizzing and bubbling behind him, and he went sort of brrr, brrr, zigzagging all round Folkestone Harbour. Fortunately, luckily, he'd had rather large spatula feet. So by using these as a rudder, he felt he could steer himself. He got up to 9 knots, strong enough to breast any tide and any change of wind or anything in the channel. And he sped, and this time his nemesis, the harbour at Dover, no longer troubled him. And the rest is history, of course. He went over to the other side, he brought across these ladies, and they undid their 44 buttons to the delight of the country. And they are still doing it, at least not them, of course, some years ago. But their daughters may still be seen in Soho doing it. And in fact, this actual occurrence of him diving in with his camphor and zooming across, the actual story is commemorated by his historian, Phineas Bunyan, who wrote the story up, and the concluding sentences are so apt and so rather heroic, they pin up the whole story. The last sentence said, "And so he passed Dover, and all the strumpets undid for him on the other side."
It's lucky John Bunyan's not alive, as that's the clearest case of slander I've heard in many months. And now we go on to Dennis Norden. If you remember, his quotation was, "The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on."
Well, I have a theory about inventors. I believe they dream up their invention first, and then afterwards try to work out a use for it. I mean, in medicine, there are researchers who discover a cure, then look around for a disease it will fit. I say this because of something that happened to me in this line. I woke up one morning with an absolutely brilliant notion. A revolving bowler hat. Yeah, well, I was just as impressed myself, because it is perfect, isn't it? And I rushed along to this wholesale hat manufacturer's, and I said, "I have something for you which could well revolutionize the industry." I said, "You've heard of the boxer revolution. This could be the bowler revolution." I said, I will call it Norden's patent revolving titfer. You can literally have your head in a whirl." And they looked at me and they said those terribly dispiriting words, "What good is it?" And I said, "Well, you know, it goes round and round." And they said, "Yes, but what for?" And I said, "Well, you know, if it's raining, you could make it go fast and fling the rain off." They said, "Our chaps who wear bowler hats carry umbrellas." I came home terribly disappointed with my revolving bowler hat. And suddenly, I had a brainwave. I knew exactly what I could use it for. For one of Mrs. Tidmarsh's fancy dress parties. Now, Mrs. Tidmarsh is our local rich person. She owns all the property from the separate shop down to the 5-minute car wash. And she gives these fancy dress parties every year on a theme. They're the worst kind of fancy dress parties. Remember the year before, it had been opera, the theme, and I've been trailing round all evening with these camellias and coughing my head off, you know. It was a draggy, you know. And I suddenly realized I could use my revolving bowler hat as an all-purpose fancy dress. And the theme that year was tragedy. It had come something from tragedy, you know. So I just went with my revolving bowler hat, you see. And she came up to me and said, "What's that?" And I said, "It's my fancy dress." She said, "Well, it's not tragic, is it?" I said, "No, but it's moving." And it was all right, you see. I got away with that. But this year was where really it came into its own. The theme was the Far East. And what I did was, I got a torch and I taped it to my skull. And I cut a small hole in the crown of the bowler hat so that as it went round, once every revolution, the light shone through. And that's what I went as, you see. And I got the lot of them because they came up and they said, "What are you?" And I said, "I'm Omar Khayyam." I said, "Omar Khayyam?" I said, "Yes, just watch it. The moving titfer lights, and having lit, moves on."
Well, Edward Fitzgerald did four versions of Omar Khayyam, and this is clearly the fifth.
And by your vote, Frank Muir wins the contest of the two stories, and Frank and Dennis Powell win the entire contest by 2 marks from Dennis Norden and Anne Scott James. And that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dennis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.